Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Impact Factor. I am your host, Katie Van Aken, and we are continuing our March routine of celebrating badass women who get their PhD in honor of Women's History Month. And this week, I had the pleasure of interviewing an old colleague of mine from Drexel who was in a different department, but we ended up hanging out a lot at the grad student events, and we have some memories of singing karaoke, and I can't wait for you to hear about it. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Jana Domenico, PhD. Wow, how long has it been since we saw each other? Probably.
Gosh, I don't know. COVID time is so weird.
I know. Like, when did you graduate from Drexel?
Officially, like 2019.
Okay. So I was still around in 2018 doing a postdoc in electrical engineering, but then I was like out of there. So I'm sure I ran into you at that point, but still, that's like 5 years, you know?
I know. Crazy. But it's nice. Nice to see you.
I know. It's nice to see you too. So I know a little bit about your story and your PhD journey, but let's start a little bit before that. Can you tell me, where did you go for undergrad? What was your undergrad experience like? Did you major in chemistry?
Yes. So when I was like even in high school, I knew I wanted to major in chemistry. I thought I was going to make cosmetics. I was like, that sounds so cool. Oh. Sounds so artistic. So I majored in chemistry right off the bat, and also Spanish, because that was something I really just liked. And I went to a smaller liberal arts school in New Jersey called William Patterson University that nobody really knows. People know Montclair. That's kind of close by.
Close by, yeah.
Liberal arts school. So I did chemistry, and it was easy to do the second major, so that's why I did it. But I started in chemistry and went through, you know, like the Gen Chem and the Orgo, and like hated the lab. And I was like, I can't be a cosmetic chemist if I hate the lab. Like, that doesn't really bode well. So I kind of was stuck a little bit and had some teachers along the way that were physical chemists. And then when I got to physical chemistry in my junior year of undergrad, I was talking in lab about how I hadn't really clicked with any labs to do my senior research project yet. And my professor was like, I can give you a theoretical project if you want. And I had no idea what that meant.
You were like, what is that?
Yeah. And he was like, well, basically you can like do your research on this like brand new Mac workstation that I just got. It's all computational. You don't have to wear a lab coat. And I was like really into that idea. So I did my senior research project with him and really liked it. And it had kind of like a alternative energy, like PN junction kind of vibe to it. So since I didn't really learn about theoretical chemistry, and nobody does until like the very end of my undergrad, that's when I was kind of like, well, I should probably keep learning about this thing. You kind of don't have a good chance in undergrad to learn in that kind of area.
So was that covered in PChem at all? Or was it like, did you have to take an elective after that? Or did you have any classes at all?
Yeah, I didn't have any classes at all formally. It was kind of like PChem 2, the book that we used for like our physical chemistry, like quantum chemistry class, like the last couple chapters, you know, that you never get to in the course were relevant. And I like tried to work on them, but I kept telling my professor, like, I don't really get this. And he was like, you're not going to get this unless you go to grad school. So
interesting.
It was kind of like I needed to do it if I wanted to do more in this area.
And so just out of curiosity, the professor that offered you this, was he doing was there an experimental side to his interest as well? Or was he strictly, you know, theoretical?
There was, yeah. And actually a paper came out of my undergrad research that one of my friends did the experimental part and I had the computational part. So I got early exposure to that kind of inner working as well, which was really cool.
That's very cool. Okay, so you sort of, you're
you're finishing undergrad, you're like, I have to keep going. Let's just do it. Did you have any thoughts between a master's and a PhD?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think I had professors at the time that were mentors, and they had PhDs, so they were kind of telling me the pros and cons, and it was kind of like, well, a master's would be like you work in industry, and I didn't know what an industry in this area would look like, you know, like a computational chemist industry, like what it, I didn't know at that point. I was, you know, a junior in college.
You just sit there and think about chemistry. That's really what they pay you to do.
Yeah, right. That would be cool. And so I was like, a PhD sounded good. I also wasn't sure if I wanted to be a professor one day, and I knew that would be, you know, the only way to get there. So that was why I only looked at PhD programs for that reason. Yeah.
Gotcha. I want to jump back for a second. What was the general focus of your undergraduate lab or research?
Yeah.
Oh, you said PN junctions. You said that.
Yeah, it was kind of PN junctions. Yeah. And it was all modeling some molecules on the computer using I know it was very user-friendly software. You like point and click, and it was like very little computer knowledge was actually involved at the time. But yes, like heterojunction material stuff.
Okay. And were you looking to continue in that path, or were you sort of open to other theoretical chemistry applications?
Yeah. So I did like the solar panel alternative energy field. That was really appealing to me. And when I started looking for research labs, I was kind of looking for anybody that did computational or theoretical work. And they kind of fell into two bins to me, at least. They were like these alternative energy focused people, or they were biology focused and kind of like either drug design or protein folding people. So it was kind
More
of like
biochem.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I decided to stick with the material science side and ended up at Drexel.
Very cool. And that's when we met through all the things that we did outside of our research.
Yes. Fond memories.
We borrowed one of your chemicals once. I don't remember what it was, but I feel like that's, I have this memory.
Oh yeah, you needed something. And I had to let you into one of the labs.
Yeah. You can always count on the chemistry department to have all the chemicals, you know?
Yeah. It wasn't my lab. My lab didn't have chemicals, but I did let you into the one that did.
Yeah. Yeah. You wouldn't have chemicals. You only need a computer, right?
Yes.
So tell me about your research group at Drexel. What did you focus on? What was the kind of structure of the group?
Yeah, so I learned once I started that I would be the sixth ever PhD student for my PI, which probably should have worried me more than it did at the time. He was a dual appointment in the material science department as well. Oh. So I knew some of the professors that you probably knew too. I had to have someone from that department on my thesis proposal committee. So he kind of was in that material science space. So he did everything from like quantum mechanics-y, wave function, Schrodinger equation, very like heavy theoretical stuff to computational materials modeling stuff, a lot of it was for the all with material science applications.
Like materials discovery or materials usage or performance.
Oh, sorry, yeah, I keep forgetting you're like person that knows about this. I'm used to talking about
sorry
that. no
many of our listeners are not, so you could also just be like, that's fine. But go ahead.
Yeah, so there were some nano machine kind of applications.
Cool.
So modeling at that scale. My bigger project was a MOF, like metal organic framework based stuff. So looking at like linker molecules and those. But a lot of them were like electronic materials, or like some had a mechanical kind of aspect to them as well.
That's cool. Yeah, I would say like 98% experimental lab, but we collaborated with a lot of theoretical labs, and I thought the papers that came out of those collaborations were the most impactful and interesting because you either have the predictive computational stuff that's confirmed experimentally, or you have like the, what weird results are we getting? Can we explain it by running some computations, which I thought was always so fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. I think now a lot of papers want both, like yeah. Journals want both in the papers, so makes it stronger.
Yeah, for sure. What kind of computational stuff did you do? Was it DFT or was it molecular dynamics? Are those the
words? Mostly. Yeah, those are the words. Very good.
It's been a long time. Great.
Yeah, so it's DFT mostly in my lab, so very quantum chemistry based. Mm-hmm. There were some solvent kind of aspects of what I was working on, so that requires MD because it's like liquids.
And, right.
Little bigger models that you're using to do those things. So, but mostly DFT. And yeah, that's definitely where I feel more comfortable.
Yeah, very cool. All right, so you were the sixth PhD student. How big was your group?
When I started, it was me and one fourth-year graduate student.
Wow.
And that was one of the hardest things for me, is that I almost feel like my first year was so amorphous and just kind of floating and not a lot of direction, not a lot of social interaction. Mm. And then my second year, we got a first-year student. So that was kind of like a really exciting change because I actually had somebody that I could mentor and that like we could talk about work together. And it wasn't just like one fourth-year PhD student who at that point, I now know, was probably already like in a very different phase of his
one foot out the door. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Did you enjoy the sort of mentoring aspect? Did that ever make you think about like pursuing teaching professor stuff?
Yeah, and I definitely only mean mentoring in the way of like, I just went through this so I can help you through it, because there's yeah. It was definitely a mutual mentoring, you know, like in
yeah.
We worked in kind of separate work areas and could get opinions about things and stuff like that, but we had definitely a few undergrads too, and that was really fun and more of like a traditional mentoring experience. And nice. I got to also mentor a high school student later in my career, which was super fun. And we published a paper together, and she's amazing and like doing all this crazy medicine stuff.
Wow. Now. What a badass high school student.
She was, you know? For sure.
Very cool. Were you required to TA at all?
Yeah, I was. All 5 years is very typical for our department.
Okay.
And I loved it. That was the best part for me, honestly. It like really changes you as a person to have to get up in front of the room. And I remember like my first day, someone was like, are you in this class? Am I in the right room? And I was like, I guess I'm in this class. I'm TAing the class.
Am You're
I
like, thank class? You. That makes me feel so young.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, we did have to do all 5 years. Research assistantships were kind of rare when I was in the department. I did end up having one because through an alumnus of my research group, I was paid as a PO contractor through Sandia National Labs. So I got to work through them for, I think it was nearly 3 years of my grad school. But I was still only like half TA most of the time.
Gotcha.
And I like it. I kept my weeks structured and
but that can be kind of like so when you first start, you have classes, you're TAing, and you're doing research, right? So
yeah,
what has the least priority in that collection? Probably research, right?
Definitely research at first, and my advisor knew that, so
okay,
he was that's very good. Understanding. Yeah, he was also very big into education, which ended up influencing me later in my career as well. So he, you know, wanted me to teach, and we respected that I cared about doing it well. And he would often mentor me in that aspect too.
That's good. So it didn't feel like either of you were just going through the motions of, you know, that part of your contracts. You know, you were like, this is something I want to do well.
Yeah, it really makes up your holistic experience as a PhD student to have to teach and hold office hours and interact with people and have difficult conversations and all of those things.
Yeah. So you're up there in front of like a big class, like at a lecture style, like a recitation or something?
Yeah, we mostly did recitations our first year and then moved into labs later on. And then
you love the labs, don't you?
Yeah, it was quite a, I was like, I told all my students, I was like, don't be fooled. I only wear this lab coat to teach. I, you know,
most of them were way to do everything else.
Yeah, yes. from home. Even then I worked from home pretty often, but yeah, the labs were fun because it was usually a smaller group and you could really get to know the students.
Very cool. I like that. I think it's good to have a well-rounded experience as a PhD student too, because you can get really bogged down by like research day-to-day failures. And if you know that you have to leave at 2 p.m. to go teach a recitation, it's just like a nice break for your brain.
Yeah, absolutely. Comes in handy when you need something else to think about, for sure.
Okay, so let's fast forward to when you were wrapping up. Did you know what you wanted to do post-PhD?
Yeah, so I had that experience with Sandia, which was really nice. And I knew that it was like a pretty traditional thing for alumni of my research group to at least look into the national lab space or the government space. So through the contractorship or whatever you want to call it, appointment with Sandia, I kind of knew that I didn't want to just do calculations and, you know, debugging all my workflows and things like that. And I was kind of drawn toward the professor thing, but not really wholeheartedly going to pursue that because it's a really hard road. And I really respect people that do it. And my PI and I had actually some really, really useful conversations in this vein where he was like, I could see you teaching, but at like a primarily undergrad institution, which I thought would be a really good fit. I think I told you at one point I was looking into a professor at Haverford to do a postdoc with.
Because that would be a perfect place to like, that's a perfect undergraduate only, like the professors are very much into teaching, but then also like mentoring undergrads. Yeah.
Yeah, so I thought that would be a really exciting fit. And then I think the professor that I wanted to do the postdoc with was leaving to go to another university.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really the best fit. So I ended up not being the person that was job hunting and finishing at the same time because I couldn't handle both of them at once.
I don't blame you, man. I don't blame you.
Yeah, it was like really hard for me to wrap up all of my research, and I felt really stuck near the end. And it was kind of like this game of like, can I just please leave? I want to be done. I think
even
I
if I don't know what's next, I just want to leave this, right?
Yeah. And I didn't know what was next, but I honestly, like, I was living with my parents at the time because I was like, oh, I don't need to renew this lease, you know, like a year ago. I was in my sixth year when I had defended. And you think you're going to tie it up in a beautiful bow at year five, and you just don't sometimes.
You just don't. And honestly, so, I think people stick around longer because of that push and pull of finishing, defending, writing, and job hunting. And it's like,
yeah,
I can't finish too quickly or I won't know where to go. And I can't like find a job before I'm ready to defend because then I'll be like all but dissertation. And then, so it's like, It's really tricky. I think it's one of the trickiest parts.
It is. It's a beautiful dance of timing everything perfectly. But I do know people that, you know, got a job offer so they could be like, hey, I got a job offer. I got to get out of here.
Yeah, and I'm out of here.
That's a power play. Good for you. And then I also know people that just got a job and were ABD and they just stayed at the job and never got the PhD officially.
Yep.
Whether their job is okay with that or not is a different story, I guess. But yeah, so there's all sorts of ways to do it. I just wanted to be done and then move on and look for things.
What was that like then after you were done? How long did you look for?
Yeah, so I kind of like, actually, I guess in my fifth year of my PhD, I went to a conference and I had a poster, which I always loved because it wasn't the pressure of a talk. You could just stand in front of your poster, chat with people. And I was standing there and like drinking my wine. Mm-hmm. And this woman walked up to me also drinking wine. And she was like, tell me about your poster. Very unassuming. And she ended up telling me about APL, which is where I work now, the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab. So like a research arm of the Johns Hopkins University. And she, but she didn't say that at first. Usually, you know, you're used to people like trying to recruit, but she yeah. talked to me at length about my poster and then mentioned where she worked and said, do you know what you want to do after graduation? Like you're in your fifth year. Do you have any idea? And I said, no, I really like teaching, but I don't want to be a professor. And she said, well, we employ a lot of people that like teaching, but don't want to be professors. So
this is where you belong.
Yeah. And it was like a really exciting thing because I really liked her. And she gave me like all these materials. So I kind of had that in the back of my mind and had been looking on their website, not hearing a ton back. And I had connected with her on LinkedIn and I was like, hey, I'm applying. And like, I didn't know this woman or where she worked. She's not HR, you know, like right. now I know she didn't have that much pull in like the actual.
You probably haven't talked to her in like over a year at that point. Right?
I actually, yeah. I actually like was just messaging her every once in a while, like feeling like a total bother.
Oh, that's good.
But yeah, but she, yeah, so I had that place in the back of my mind, but wasn't hearing back. I interviewed with a software company actually, because I was like, I gained some computer skills through this mm-hmm. whole thing, so I could try to do that. And it was in Philadelphia, so I took like public transport, like right in Center City, very much like the ping pong atmosphere software company. Oh, yeah. It was very chill. I interviewed with everyone younger than me. It was a very weird interview, but I think I did not get offered the job, and I think it was because they asked for a salary requirement, and it was probably beyond what they expected to pay because I don't think a lot of people at the company had PhDs.
Yeah.
So
because they don't necessarily need one to, you know, work in software. So yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I held out for the APL job, and it had been like 4 months since I actually like, you know, signed all the paperwork and got mm-hmm. my thesis printed or whatever. And I applied, but didn't hear back. And then 2 months after that, I actually heard back like, we're so sorry. We just saw your application and things were really delayed. So after that, it was like December 1st when I heard back. Had like a quick phone screen the next week, a visit the week after that, and then started like a month later. It was very quick after that. So it kind of made up for the lost time trying to figure out a good date.
We'll take you. Now you have to move to Maryland. Like, you know, that's exciting though. It's an adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. I tried to push it off because, you know, once you have the job, then you're like, wait, I have to start working for the rest of my life now.
Yeah.
So
true.
It was kind of nice to have some built-in like time. It felt like forever at the time, of course. I was living with my parents and I just wanted to like move on. But now I'm like, man, that was kind of nice to just be job hunting. And I'm very grateful for their support during that time.
Yeah. I want to hop back to your comment about posters, because I think one of the best things about doing a poster at a conference versus a talk is it ends up being, it's like a little awkward, right? Because you're just standing there if no one's talking to you. But when you do strike up a conversation, it becomes very collaborative and informative. And you also like make some connections with people and like design collaborations. Whereas with a talk, it's always like you're talking at this group of people and you don't know what they're thinking. And sometimes they ask you hard, mean questions and then you just feel sad. So
absolutely. Yeah.
I love the poster. What conference was it? Was it MRS?
It was MRS in Boston.
Aha. Yes. I'll also plug the MRS conferences because they do a great poster session with nice beverages and snacks. So
yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it's not like the ACS ones, the American Chemical Society ones are like usually till 10 PM. So those are fun in a different way.
Yeah.
MRS ones are really collaborative and educational too.
Yeah. Good times. All right. So what are you doing at your current job? And you've been there ever since now. So what's that?
Four years? I started January 2020. So it took from like It was defense like May 2019, and then corrections and paperwork was August 2019. I think that was like the deadline for summer graduation or something like that at Drexel. And then from August to like December was just looking and being sad. But January 2020, I started my job as a postdoc, actually. So when I interviewed at APL, they were telling me about their postdoc program. And I had applied to the listing that said postdoc, and I had applied to the listing that just said, you know, senior staff. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know what that meant at the time, but APL has a unique postdoc program, which is you're kind of not classified as a postdoc to anybody but like HR. So you're very much on the same level as other people. I have friends that did government postdocs, and it's very kind of hierarchical in nature.
Uh-huh. But National Lab, too, I think, is postdoc, and then staff scientist is above. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So I was kind of given the choice of, like, do you want to be a postdoc or do you want to be senior staff? And it feels like you should pick senior staff. But APL is a contractor organization, so we're not the government, we're not academia. It's kind of like in the middle of all of these things. And we charge our time. So my people that I interviewed with were like, the postdoc, you get 50% of your time to do research, to like carve out your niche. You have like hours to charge that you can actually do like professional development activities kind of like on the clock. Whereas for a staff scientist, that would probably be, or a senior scientist, we say, probably be kind of harder to justify some things. And you got like full benefits. It was a very competitive salary. So the postdoc was a good experience, and I spent 2 years as a postdoc on paper. The kind of next step after doing theoretical computational work is machine learning nowadays. Mm. So when I interviewed at APL, they said, what would you...
With a robot, of course, right? A robot interviewed you.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually a mathematical modeling section in a mechanical engineering group. So... I work amongst tons of mechanical engineers now, and kind of have no idea. I had no idea for sure what mechanical engineering meant, and like,
yeah,
very inspiring now. But when I interviewed, they were like, "What would you want to do now, like with your time, like with your research project, independent research?" The professor that I wanted to work for at Haverford also was in this like machine learning for material science space. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the next step. And I was explaining that to the people that I was interviewing with, and they had just written this big proposal in that space. So they were like, this is a great fit. So I started just doing like learning babies first machine learning stuff, and had all this postdoc time to learn stuff, which was awesome. Rather than starting as a senior scientist and kind of getting thrown to the wolves a little bit more, I liked being a postdoc for a little bit, and then I was able to, we call it reclassify, to senior scientist in January 2022.
So nice. So a couple questions. Mm-hmm. One, or I guess this is the question, but I feel like you made the right decision, not that you care what I think, but because you enjoy learning, right? You've done, you know, all the way up through your PhD, and I feel like having one of the biggest challenges that I and other people face in industry, I think, is that you are at the will of the company's, like, bottom line, mm-hmm. right? And so being given that time to go and learn new things and, like, and even, like, come up with ideas that could benefit, you know, is very cool. And I think that's that does sound like kind of like a perfect transition, too, out of a PhD, right?
Yeah, for sure. So APL is a not-for-profit kind of like trusted agent for the government. So we work with the university on some certain like special grants, and we have like the government funds a lot of our research. So like DART was the big mission that was just all over the news. That was APL. Mm-hmm. And like Dragonfly, other space mission coming in like 2026, I think it is. So they're kind of big in the space domain. And the first big thing was like the VT fuse in World War II. So they're very much like this like air and missile defense and like all of these kind of like big space programs. So that's kind of like the outward facing APL. And then I work in the research and development department. So I work kind of like internally facing where we have these independent like internal research and development efforts and we can write little mini proposals to just APL. In addition to like writing proposals to the NSF or wherever else.
Nice. Did you have proposal writing experience pre-APL?
Yeah, I think my only proposal writing experience was like the GRFP, right? They make you write like
early on in your PhD program. Yeah.
Yes. I applied to that, but didn't get it. But I was like really overwhelmed by that process because, you know, it's like, you're just trying to get through your first year or whatever of your PhD.
Yeah.
And it's like, what am I going to propose? I don't know. What does this look like? Yeah. And you're reading all these examples. It's crazy.
And everyone's telling you, like, it's fine. You don't actually have to do it. And I'm like, well, then why do I have to come up with it? Like, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. It's really hard. And it's proposal writing is still, like, really challenging. And I had to do a little bit right in the beginning of APL, too, because... You know, it's like, oh, we're writing this proposal and you're the new hire. So you want to be like, oh, I'll help you. I'll write it. And then I was like, what the heck am I even doing? But
I'll write it. Don't know how, but I'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so interesting. So I have to ask you, what do you think about this like whole ChatGPT machine learning phase that we're in and how that applies to grad school? I was talking to someone recently about how, like, if I could just like sit down and like ask my computer something about like the literature, you know, I would just like have saved so much time. But I want to know your thoughts.
Yeah, that's a really good like application idea for that. So I do know that it isn't, I don't know how often they're updating it, but I know for literature, if you're, you know, locked into just pre-2019 or whatever it's at with their training materials.
Yeah.
And probably not the best for like cutting edge spaces, but definitely like historical things, that's a game changer. I could see that being really used. We're talking at work now about like, don't put any of our intellectual property through ChatGPT, you know, like ask it a question about something you're working on. Yeah. Exactly. I think it's cool. I think at the very least, like getting people excited about it is a nice thing. Like it's in the public eye. People can be curious and look into it. There's a lot of fear around it, but I think like, especially APL trying to always like publicize the good, mm-hmm. good that can come out of it. I think, yeah, for grad school as like a quick summary tool, I think that's pretty nice. I don't know. Lots of thoughts. I think like the biggest fear, I guess, is like improper usage, right? So it could be wrong. I think that's like always the thing that I tell people about machine learning. Even people I work with, they're like, can you machine learning-ify this problem and wave your magic wand? And it's not really that easy. And you have to have people in the loop to like vet this thing, right? Make sure that's doing on the right path. So I think blind trust is definitely a scary area of AI, but you know,
and I think bias too is always a problem, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's something that I've seen. You know, I work in medical devices, and you know, all of the companies that we work with that are using AI, they deal with that, you know, when they're building their algorithms, is like, how do you combat the bias that comes out of the fact that your training set is made up of X, Y, Z, you know?
Yeah.
Which I think is so fascinating.
Yeah, we work with bias in like machine learning for material science too, which is cool because it's kind of the same idea, but for material science. So for example, we work in the superconductivity space right now. That was kind of my first big project at APL. So can we discover new superconductors? And a lot of that data is biased, right? Because it's only the superconductors that have been discovered. So you have to do a lot of this extra work to kind of like scan in an efficient way.
So having it like come up with something totally random out of nowhere would be hard because there's nothing pointing it to that, right? There's no trail.
Yeah, absolutely. So you could get really good at what you know, but really not good at other things. And what we might really want to discover is kind of totally different, maybe from what we already know.
Wow. Great answer. Good discussion. This is some good stuff.
Thanks.
Let's see. Let me check my questions. Is there anything you miss about your PhD time in your life?
Yeah, I miss like the social aspect of it, right? Because it's like terrible and everyone is feeling terrible, but like you have this like total sense of community, even with people you don't know, because you have this like shared commonality of being like struggling through grad school or whatever it is. I think Drexel did a decent job of creating community with like the chem like the well the total like grad student association events, and then we had like our mini grad student associations throughout our departments. So it gave you some people to go to happy hour with. You know, I have this memory of you like belching out Celine Dion in Chinatown one night.
Oh, yeah, that did happen. Yep.
It's pretty like random. I was thinking about that randomly the other day. So
That
I feel
same
like it's
night
fun.
I have this memory. I think it was like of all of us in a group, like in a circle with like our arms over our sh each shoulders and like swaying while we all sang like Third Eye Blind or some like kind of emo song, and it was just like whoever put it on was like, just trust me, it'll be great. And it was great. It was great. Oh, good
Yeah,
times.
I don't
Good
know what that
times.
was even for, but yeah, I
Don't
think
know.
that like sums it up. I feel like I miss those times where like everyone was like freer. You had more free time, right, in grad school. At least I did. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I feel like you have more free time to do fun things like that.
Yeah, very cool. So I like to ask this question so my listeners get to know you as a person, but so what are some things or hobbies that you have either picked up post PhD or have continued to do, or what do you like to do outside of work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I always hate that question because I can't be like, I love camping because I don't. Yeah.
Everybody has something, you know? Even though you think it's not interesting, right?
Yeah, I guess so. So, like post PhD, well, I didn't really do anything outside of work except like happy hour during my PhD. I know like some people
Understandable.
get really like they really get into other things, and I do think you have to have other things. I actually had other things in the form of like an education kind of minor, graduate minor.
Oh,
So
cool.
that was kind of my like a nerdy fun outlet, I guess. But I guess I also got really into like astrology during my PhD. I don't know if I ever talked to you. I probably did talk to you about that at some
Yes.
point.
So here's my story about that. So I remember being at a happy hour with you, and you came over to me and you were like, "Katie, are you an Aquarius?" And I was like, "Yes." And I was just like blown away because you were doing it to everybody. And I was like, "I don't understand how this works." So continue. Tell us
So
more.
funny. Yeah, I don't know. So I think it comes from like, you know, being lost in your life, right? And like meetings, just having like a fun outlet. So I think like I was talking to my lab mate at the time, and she was like, well, I was very aware of like pop culture astrology growing up. Like my parents knew about it and were into it and like, you know, would buy like the little things with stuff on them. So I knew I was a Taurus. growing up. And then my lab mate was like, "Do you know your moon sign?" And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And then I just like dove into astrology. And it was like a nice way to make sense of the world when you're kind of lost and figuring stuff out and figuring out who you are and getting to know people in like a very fast pace sometimes. So yeah, I feel like that became like something I would read about, and there is like some math and like astronomy components to it that are very intellectual and nerdy too. And it's also like a beautiful artistic thing. So it's kind of like this combination of a lot of fun things. But That's like my deep, dark secret that I don't always tell people that I'm into.
Well, now you're telling all my listeners. But I honestly still tell people about that sometimes because, like, I don't know anything about astrology. But when people bring it up, I'm like, look, I'm like a little bit sold because this girl I went to grad school with walked up to me once and was just like, I know your sign. And I was like, it must be somewhat real.
I think it's like always nice because at least if it's not real, you have this opportunity to reflect. And like figure out like, is it really not real or do I not want it to be real? So sometimes people will read something about their like moon sign and be like, oh no, this is all totally fake. But maybe you just need to do some soul searching.
Some soul searching. Huh. That's interesting. Wow. So deep.
Very cool. I mean, I also, I guess like fluffier things, like I got into like alcohol ink painting recently. I'm trying to get more into like creative kind of turn your brain off outlets that are not super intellectual. So
I can relate. I got into paint by number recently.
Cool. Yeah, I got some of those too.
The nice thing about it is like I can do it while I'm like listening to TV.
Mm-hmm.
But then also at the end of it, I have like this nice piece of artwork for my house.
Yeah.
So unlike a puzzle where you do a puzzle and then you're like, nah, I put that away, you know?
Yeah. Or you like glue it and then it still looks like a puzzle.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I alternate between puzzles and paint by numbers because they're good activities.
Very much like an inside person though. Not like creative. Yeah. I wish I could be like, oh, I climb mountains. It's
you don't have to like climbing mountains. It's okay. There's not that many mountains in Baltimore, right?
Oh yeah.
Or in Maryland.
Yeah, probably not until you go a little further west.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to hop to my three wrap questions, unless you have anything you want to talk about, else you want to talk about, or
I feel like I could talk about this forever. I like how you said, like, I think it was in the trailer that you, like, had all this stuff in your head and you just wanted to get it out. Like, that is so true. I feel like I work a lot with
them. You're
never
going to use it again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And especially if you're not a professor and you can't, like, advise your own graduate students. Like, you have nothing. But I feel like I work now with our APL's high school internship program and get a lot of FaceTime with these, like, 17, 18-year-olds that, like, want to go to Yale or think they have to go to Yale or their life is over. So I do a lot of talking with them about grad school and things like that. But yeah, other than that, I don't have a lot of opportunity to share things, but
yeah. Well, this is a good place and we can always have you back. I like to do some like topical discussions where I bring like specific people back and talk about things like, I don't know, ChatGPT. I don't know.
Yeah,
or like machine learning or something. That'd be cool. But I digress. Okay. So the first question is, can you tell me something challenging that you faced in your PhD journey?
Yeah, so definitely one of the most challenging things was like early on being the only, like only in quotes, but I felt very much like the only graduate student in the group. That first year is so make or break, I feel, for like getting a rhythm. And I think, like, looking back, I wish I was a little more disciplined with myself, but I didn't have a lot of, like, role models, I guess, in the area. So that was something challenging. And then kind of alluding to, like, finishing was super challenging. And just, when are you done? You know, when can I be done, like, for myself? When can my PI agree that I'm done? When can I be done with all these revisions? Like, no one's going to read this thing. Can I just be done with this?
Why do you care so much? You're not going to read it. Yeah. I found, not recently, but way after I had graduated, I found an unfinished sentence in my dissertation. So clearly nobody read it and even I didn't catch it. So, but I know where it is. I know exactly where it is, but clearly I was like writing it and got like interrupted or something and never went back.
I don't even want to know. I will have it bound on my bookshelf and I will just leave it there closed.
It'll stay there. Yeah. Okay, so maybe related, maybe not, but what advice would you give yourself in year one?
Yeah, I think, like, probably to be a little more structured or to like find that structure for yourself, because coming from undergrad, like I guess even undergrad could be as structured or not structured as you kind of make it. But yeah, there was, it was a lot of, Drexel was a weird program too, where the number of classes that you take could vary so much based on how you performed on your entrance exams at the time. I think they have changed it because they realized that was a very weird system. But I ended up really only having like two classes, and they were very late at night, and I was computational, so I wasn't in the, I didn't need to be in the lab a lot. My PI was very hands-off. So it's kind of like this perfect storm of
like being alone.
Being alone and being like left to your own devices and up to you to make your structure, and there's no external pressure from anyone. So I still feel that way kind of now at my job, but it's a little more, you know, rigorous. Post-COVID, everyone's a little more flexible, but I kind of learned how to handle that flexibility earlier than I knew how to handle it.
Do you think if you had sort of approached your PI and been like, I need to meet with you at this cadence just, you know, to provide some structure, that that would have helped, or that they would have been open to it?
I think they would have been open to it. They were like by nature very hands off. And I think there were some people that wanted to meet, but then found that the meetings were kind of unsatisfactory because it was kind of like shorter than they would have were anticipating. Like, oh, here's my meeting, like, here's what I want to talk about. And then it's like, okay, like, sounds good. You know, so a little bit probably, but there's still that potential for being unsatisfied after you go through all this effort of like making the structure.
Yeah. It's so funny because I feel like the way I would describe a PhD is like, it's an independent journey in a sea of other people doing their same, like doing an independent journey, you know, like we go to happy hour because we're all in the same boat, but like each of our experience is different, and like our paper publishing and our the way our research is going and like what we want to do next, like it's all different, but we can all relate at least at that level of like, this is tough sometimes, you know?
Yeah, it's so true. And it's so hard not to compare yourself too. Especially like in the same research group, there's like always that competition that is awful, and it should be up to, you know, the PI or something to not have there be. And like even different disciplines in chemistry are very different with their publishing cadence and things like that. So setting publication requirements for graduation and things like that were always like hot button issues.
For sure. Okay, so we're gonna end on a good note. So we've shared a few already, but if you can share a good memory you have from your program or story, maybe a conference trip or a department event or something that you always kind of look back on fondly.
Yeah, I did share a lot of those. Gosh, I feel like they're all like fun social things. I know like I had a really good conversation with my PI at the end of my, well, toward the end of my PhD. I can't even remember how close I was at the time, but it was kind of like not academic at all, not about like research I wasn't doing or things I should have done and didn't do. Like it was just about like moving forward. Like I think the being a professor at an undergrad institution, like those kinds of life conversations really stick out to me. Like when I got to talk to professors as humans, we only had like one or two women in our department that really were in a position to give you mentoring advice. So anytime I got to make those opportunities, I tried to do that. Those stick out as like, you know, like life-saving, career-saving conversations when you can be like, hey, you're a person I need to connect and hear some good advice. And then, yeah, Drexel had some decent events, and the chem department was pretty good about like holiday parties. Those were always really fun. And the mass spectrometer people, mass spec group would bring like beer that they were analyzing or brewing for their classes, which was cool.
Interesting.
Cool perk.
Cool perk. They're in the right field. Yeah, that's really cool. I think, you know, in the spirit of, is it yeah, it's still March, right? So it's still Women's
History Month,
right? So I'm trying to interview only women this month, or I'm trying to have the episodes be only women. And you make such a good point that, like, just one conversation with, like, a woman professor or someone in a position that you could see yourself in makes a huge difference when you're just, like, thinking about your future.
Absolutely. Yeah. We had one woman undergrad, or in my undergrad, one woman professor.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, one day I, like, went to her office hours and noticed she was very pregnant. And she was, like, in her 40s, like, not, like, would not have thought. And we talked a long time about that and about, like, how difficult it is. You're doing your postdoc and your PhD, like, your PhD and your postdoc, and you're trying to get tenure. And she was like, you know, this was my time to have a baby. And, like, I was, you know, 21. And I was like, wow, this is really eye-opening, really insightful. Lucky to have, like, just one really strong woman in undergrad and one in grad school. And it was like,
yeah,
you know, bottom line, but
love to have more, but at least we had that, right?
At least we had one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had one. I don't know how it was for you over in.
We were more split, actually. We had more of a balance. In my undergrad, though, I majored in physics, and there was like one physics woman professor and one astronomy professor that was a woman. So similarly, you know, those were the people that helped you just to look up and say, you know, that could be me, you know, because it can be that simple, you know, which I find so interesting and also frustrating, because, you know, we talk about in the STEM world of the leaky pipe, right? And have you have more and more people that drop out of STEM, or women that drop out of STEM, and it's just like, we need more people to make it to the end so that the younger people can see them there. And it's just, it's a slow process, but I'm optimistic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I try to think about that now when I work with interns, like high school interns, college interns. Like, if I could just I try to carve out time to just share my career path. I call them like career path talks, career path panels. Non-technical, and just like, who are you as a person? What challenges have you faced? I always ask about being a woman, or say something about being a woman, even though it's always, you know, awkward, I want to say. Like, I don't want it to be awkward, but I'm always that person that's like, how many women were in your, you know, undergrad? It's got to be
talked about. Yeah. And also, I think, like, hearing other people's, like, the decisions they made along the way, you know, there might have been decisions made because of the women in their life, you know, like the conversations you had with the woman professor may be one of the reasons that you're here today. And so all of those things, I think, tie in. It's very interesting.
Yeah, that's awesome that you're doing that.
All right, well, that is all I have. Anything else you want to talk about?
I think we covered covered almost everything.
If you think of it, we'll have you back. We'll do it again. It'll be great. But yeah, so thank you for your time. Thank you for coming on the show. It was really fun.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was super fun, and I always love talking about this, so feel free to reach out.
Thanks to Jenna for coming on the show. If you or someone you know wants to be interviewed on Impact Factor, feel free to reach out via Instagram and follow us for updates at @impactfactorpod. Thank you all for listening, and have a great week.